Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Lucy Weston, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Chick Flick Chat, a spin-off feature of the popular Life and Style website, Here We Are with Lucy.com. The basis of the Here We Are mission is to inspire your independence, support your personal growth, and make your busy day better, brighter, and easier. We do cover a lot of topics like food, relationships, health and wellness, house and home, and so much more. In fact, Chick Flick Chat emerged because movies are a great escape from the busyness of life. So if you like this movie review and discussion show, then share it with other movie lovers who might like it too. You could tweet it, like it on Facebook, share it on Google+, and I thank you in advance for doing any of that sharing. It's really important, and we like to get the word out, so thank you so much for that. It's Thursday, June 7th, 2012, and today we are switching things up a bit here at Chick Flick Chat. Instead of my regular co-host, Susan Rigazzo, I have a very special guest co-host, Debbie Woodbury, and she's joining me today to discuss today's feature film, which is The Descendants. Debbie is the founder and editor of WhereWeGoNow.com. It's an inspirational community of survivors celebrating joyous growth after trauma. Debbie's cancer survivorship is just the tip of her iceberg. Before cancer, she survived family and career dysfunction, being laid off, a cheating boyfriend, miscarriages, and infertility. Cancer gave Debbie the label of survivor, but she's learned that she's really been a survivor for some time. Long before she heard the words, "you have cancer," she was someone who continued to function and prosper in spite of opposition, hardship, or setbacks. Debbie is the embodiment of the word survivor, and her mission is to share the message that you are too. To learn more about Debbie Woodbury, please check out WhereWeGoNow.com, and join her inspirational newsletter, share her uplifting articles. I know you'll find something there that will help you or someone you know. In fact, I got to know Debbie after she appeared as a guest on the Here We Are talk show in the episode Life Beyond Breast Cancer, Healing the Mind, Body, and Spirit. Welcome, Debbie. I am so happy you are here to share your unique perspective while we discuss, dissect, and dish the details of today's film.
Hi, Lucy. I'm so excited to be your guest co-host today. This is a great movie to talk about, and I can't wait to get started.
Oh, it is, right? There's so much. And listeners, as with the previous Chick Flick Chats, I just want you to know that my co-host, today's co-host Debbie and I, we have not discussed the film prior to airtime, and I don't do that with any of the co-hosts because we want it to be fresh and you know, a nice banter for you, and you can follow along with us. And, you know, there's so much to cover in this film. We won't be taking any calls today. So, Debbie, let's get started. Would you like to tell us the premise of this film, The Descendants?
Sure. This is paraphrased from the Fox Searchlight synopsis. The film, The Descendants, is directed by Alexander Payne and is set in Hawaii. Matt King, who's played by George Clooney, is an indifferent husband and father of two girls, Alex, played by Shailene Woodley, and Scotty, played by Amara Miller. Matt is forced to reexamine his past and embrace his future after his wife suffers a devastating injury from a boating accident, all the while wrestling with a decision to sell the family's land handed down from Matt's descendants. This film also stars Beau Bridges, Robert Forster, Judy Greer, and Nick Kraus.
Thank you, Debbie. Like always on Chick Flick Chat, let's begin at the beginning. And just listeners, so you know, there's so much in this film. We're probably going to jump around a little bit. So we'll try to go chronologically, but, you know, things come up. in the opening scene, we see this vibrant woman speeding along on a boat, and you see the big city of Waikiki behind her, and it's this beautiful, you know, open ocean. And then it cuts to city sites, and you hear George Clooney as Matt King talking about the reality of living in Hawaii or any place that's considered paradise for that matter. And via this voiceover, we learn that the woman that we've just seen, it was launched from that powerboat and hit her head. And he says it's been 23 days, you know, since this happened, that they haven't spoken, but really they haven't spoken in months. Events like this can really put things into perspective. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. It just brings everything short where, you know, you're going along in your life thinking that this is what you do, whether you like it or not. You know, it's kind of, you kind of have your head down, and all of a sudden life calls your attention to what's really going on.
And I think in the fact that he says that they haven't, he finally realizes that they haven't spoken in months.
Right.
Which, you know, you think you're kind of communicating with people, and then something like you can't communicate with them, and suddenly it brings it right up to
right.
front and center.
Yeah, and he says that for 3 days before the accident, he was on business, and during those 3 days, they literally didn't talk at all. So it just shows you how disconnected they are. And then he says, but in fact, we really weren't speaking for months.
Right.
So it's much worse than he even realized until he's really faced with it, you know, with this tragedy.
And I guess I hadn't thought of this before, but in when you said that, it reminds me of, like, you don't know what you have until it's gone.
Right. And if you recall, as he's walking into the hospital, he starts negotiating with his God, basically, you know, I'll be a better husband, I'll be a better father, just wake up. You know, I'm
right,
ready
the
now.
Whole
he's saying, I'm
making
ready
promises,
now.
Yes,
right,
that
right.
people do. And he talks about... We find out in his opinion, he's got these two girls, and he thinks he's the backup parent.
Right, I
and
love that.
And that, now he's the sole trustee of these two girls. And it's funny, in the you have, everybody has dynamics and relationships, and we see that so much in this film. We only really see his perspective, obviously, because she's incapacitated in the bed for the entire movie. So
right.
here we have this guy, Matt King, now he's trying to be the parent he hasn't been, and he doesn't really have any tools to do so.
Right. And he really is the backup, because now that she's lying in a bed, he really is called to do the job that he now is admitting that she did completely by herself. And now all of a sudden he says, you know, with his, you see the 10-year-old first, and he says, I don't know what to do with her. You know, I haven't really taken care of her since she was months old or days old. I mean, it's been that long since he's taken care of his own child.
Which is funny, because you know he's been in the house and he's there, but he's not really there.
Right, right. And I think that's what so much of the movie is about his disconnect, but it also then he starts seeing other people's disconnect. You know, through his eyes, he starts realizing that he's not the only one who's disconnected from his own life. But as we go through the movies, he's realizing he's disconnected from many people. It wasn't just his wife. It wasn't just his children. It was from the land as well, you know, from his family.
Right.
His
I'm glad you brought up the land. There's this whole it's a side story going on, where it's paralleling what's happening with her in the bed. They've got six days to figure out a decision about land that's been entrusted to them from 150 years ago from the family, which were missionaries. And it's a sort of the parallel of time, what we think of as time in today's moment-to-moment aspect versus eternity, because the land has been there forever. And
right.
yet they've got this sort of like, well, we've got 6 days to figure this out, and she's probably only got 6 days to live. So there's sort of this,
right.
you know, kind of time continuum thing going on way under the, you know, in the subtext
right.
of everything.
And just like his children becoming solely his, this decision about the land is solely his. And he
Good
now
point.
Is faced with all these things that have come to bear at the same moment in time, and he must take care of them. Like, he can't be indifferent or distracted anymore. He really has to pay attention and step up. He really has to step up.
And do you think that that's something that, from your experience, you know, in being an expert in survivorship, do you think that's something that many people in any kind of ordeal face, that is suddenly like a reality, either you have to grow up or you have to kind of wake up?
I think that whatever your tragedy is, you know, be it cancer or be it whatever it is, a lot of times, I think usually, you know, that crisis is not planned and it just falls in your lap. And now you are required to deal with it. And with that comes all these other issues. You know, I found when I was going through cancer that, you know, I really, I really was dealing with a lot of other issues as well, because it just brings your attention to your entire life. And, you know, it's time to really kind of think things through a little better than you've been doing, living day to day, just doing your daily work, you know, your daily life. So I think it forces you to pay attention and to ask questions, you know, be a little more introspective. And maybe that's just me, but I've talked to other people who seem to have, you know, a similar reaction to it. And I think that's what he's going through.
Yes, and what you just said reminded me of the word clarity. Like suddenly mm-hmm. he's getting all this clarity about where he's been, where the wife's been in the relationship, the kids, like
right.
all the perspective. And then
right.
he gets even more clarity when he goes home and he tells the oldest daughter, after he has to go get her at school, and
yes.
they bring her home. And we find out, and a lot of what I liked in this movie, I don't know if you like this or not, we find out a lot about everybody in the backstory.
Yes,
there's absolutely. It's not necessarily, you know, what's going on. I mean, we find out that the kids had some drinking and drug problems and bad choices with boys
right.
in the past. And she's, you know, maybe copying the mother. And, you know, there's things we're finding, and we find out all about the mother only through the backstory and,
right.
and her influence on everybody. I thought that was an interesting use of that vehicle because, you know, sometimes there's a lot of detail and you don't need it. But the way that it was directed and written in, I just thought it was seamless.
Right. Well, when he talks about, you know, what's wrong with the women in my life, they're trying to self-destruct, and he says, you know, he talks about his wife loving motorcycles and speedboats, and he mentions alcohol. And it's the only time he says that. And then he talks about his daughter, and she's got a drug problem, and she likes older men or older guys. And, you know, he's realizing that he's telling you that they have their own problems. And he's, you know, he's in the story, he's not the only one that's disconnected. The wife was definitely disconnected too, you know.
Right.
That it's not just, and basically we're looking in and saying, well, it's not just him, that he wasn't around. You know, what was she doing? And she was
self-medicating. When you just said that about the daughter liking older men, I wonder if that's the daddy complex happening, because he was so disconnected.
Right, right.
I hadn't thought about that before.
Alex tells him right away. You know, as soon as she comes home, like, right away she says about Scotty, like, you know, what have you been doing with her? You know, and if
right.
you're obviously doing nothing because you're not around. Like, why is she talking like this? Why is she dressing
right.
like this? You know, she's
and
calling
and I do,
carpet.
I have to say, the two girls were very well cast and really, mm. really good actors. And it was
Excellent.
A very nice ensemble put together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we find out from Alex, the older daughter, that the wife has been cheating on Matt. And, you know, When I saw the movie the first time, I have to say, and I'm sorry, George Clooney, I love you, but I thought, well, I don't know what the hype is. But after sitting through the film the second time and really to note it for this chick flick chat, mm-hmm. I really noticed his nuances and the simplicity, but the depth of his performance.
Oh, yeah.
And what was behind the eyes and the moments mm-hmm. that he had. And, you know, in the clip when you saw the movie advertised and he's running down the street in his Docksiders and he's
yes.
making that turn, it's kind of comical. But
right.
when you watch the film, it's just so – there's no dialogue. He puts those shoes on and he goes to his friend's house for maybe, you know, more clarity or to hear the truth or whether he wants to know it or not. That running, there's something in that desperate running that he has is just so emotional.
Right, right. And what I also thought is how he handles the news. He's the first one to be told she's not going to make it. And he goes to the room immediately thereafter, and he runs into these same friends who are put, you know, the woman's putting makeup on
mm-hmm.
the corpse, as he later tells her when he, you know, is angry at her for keeping the secret. But he changes his demeanor immediately and doesn't let them know. And then later when he tells her, the same person, he's so angry and he's mean to her. You know, he tells
right.
her basically you're putting, you know, lipstick on a corpse, and it's because he's angry that she kept the secret. But you see him working through all these emotions of being protective, you know, and when his wife's father, who's so mean to him, he's always very protective of him. In the end, like, he doesn't, when he says, you know, she was a good, true wife, she didn't deserve this, and he just gets, George Clooney just gets quiet and then says, you're right.
Right.
And
he
we all know he could have told
him. She was a faithful wife, and we know
exactly.
she wasn't.
Exactly.
But
that was the word.
Yeah. He doesn't
He just
tell
gets
father.
Quiet. And he just kind of, and then he goes out in the hall, and the three of them look in and see this poor father dealing with the death of his child. And there's all this empathy and love for somebody who doesn't always deserve it, but
right.
you know, you feel his pain.
Who hasn't given back, right.
Right, right. And so I think with George Clooney, you're just seeing somebody who is flawed, definitely, but is trying really hard to get past that and to understand, you know, how did I get in this mess, basically? You know, how did it get so bad?
And working moment to moment. I mean, and I don't mean that in the acting
right.
term of working, but really working
right.
moment to moment as a person to try to get just to deal with what's coming every day to him.
Right.
I want to go back to the moment when he does go to the house with the friends, Matt and Mark and Kai, and
mm-hmm.
she says to Matt, George Clooney's character, it's not her fault. She was lonely.
Right.
So it's almost like it's his fault she cheated.
Right. And that's what she's telling him at that point, you know,
mm-hmm.
you were a bad husband. But again, I think that goes back to when he said, you know, she was a thrill seeker. I mean, her parents, her father backs that up saying, you know, you should have bought her own boat and blah, blah, blah. And there's an issue, too, that's kind of, and I was wondering if the book would talk about this and flesh this out more, but you get a hint of it in the movie. This idea where he says early on, you know, a lot of my cousins squandered their part of the trust, but I still have my money and I live off my law practice as my father did, you know, and now the father is saying to him, you should have spent more money, you didn't give your wife enough, you know, she should have gone shopping. So there's this kind of money issue in there as well.
Right, and the money is, well, and also this is how it comes up with the whole Brian Spear issue when we find out
right.
that the guy that she's having the affair with, his first of all, his name is Spear, S-P-E-E-R, which his friend Mark has to spell for him instead of the spear through the heart, S-P-E-A-R. So I thought, oh,
yes.
a little irony
yes,
there.
Exactly.
And, you know,
yes.
So you have this guy now. He's on this mission of, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting that he did ask the friends was he said, does she love him?
Right. Right.
You know, and I think that's where everybody, when you go through something like this, your mind goes to that. It's like, well, does she love him? Because then that's like the ultimate betrayal.
Right. And what I thought was really interesting about that is he knows at that point that she's going to die. So you could say, well, what difference did it make if she loved him or not? Because it's not like she's going to leave
point.
You.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is leaving you. But that's not the point at all. The point is, you know, this person who I love, because you know he loves her, you know, doesn't love me. So that betrayal, even though it doesn't really matter anymore technically, really does matter.
And he'll carry
that
with
several
him.
Times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter, right? That's a good point, Debbie, because it doesn't matter when you find something like that out, no matter
right.
what condition that person's in, you're going to carry that hurt with you now.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then he does go to the hospital room, and he sort of has the how could you speech to her.
Right. Mm-hmm.
After he finds out, like, how could you do this? And, you know, it's even though she can't answer, there's no answers.
Right.
And, you know, it's and then Alex comes in and she sort of has it out with the mother and he says to her, you know, don't spoil it for Scotty. So,
right.
again, you're right. He is protecting the mother and the different relationships she had. You know, and then he has the party at the house to tell everyone it's time to visit her. It's time to, you know.
Right.
There's
right.
not much time left that she has. You've got to do it now. Don't do it after, which I think was one of the most important lines in the movie. And
mm-hmm.
it was almost seemed like a throwaway, but, you know, do it now. See people now
right.
while they're alive,
right.
even though in her case she's
right.
comatose. But it's, you know, it's do it before they, you know, before you can't tell them what you need to tell them.
Right. And doesn't that go back to him being so disconnected before this happened where he didn't know his children and he wasn't close to his wife? And now he's, you know, he's dragging his two kids around over these various islands, chasing this guy with the boyfriend, and, you know, Sid. He's just, you know, now he's really connected, and wherever he goes, they go, and he's now becoming closer, you know, at this point to these.
And
people.
They're becoming a unit. They're becoming the family unit they weren't prior to this.
Right. I mean, his daughter just right away, as much as she comes in, you know, with all this teenage anger. Right, almost immediately, you know, sides with him in the sense that, you know, that's why she was so angry at the mother, and that's why she, you know, said what she said, and she's angry at him too, but she still does see him as, you know, he's a good guy, and that's why she wants to help him out to go after Brian Spear.
Right, and I think she also feels a little sorry for him.
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. You know, where she's like, Dad, didn't you know you're the only one? You know, you,
right.
It was sort of a little bit of pity where she realizes he needs her help. And it's,
right.
I think it's interesting that she's the female and we see these roles. Like, the mother is there and we find out that this the mother, Elizabeth, had so many connections with so many people who thought she was so strong and she was a rock and she was this and she was that.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then you have this kid who prior to this was obviously floundering, and now she's rising up in her own role with Scotty and with the father and also with her friend Sid, who shows up, who's sort of the comic relief clown, if you will, character that goes along with them. And we find out he's dealing with his own stuff, too. We just think
right,
he's there
right.
for extra, but he's got his own stuff he's working mm-hmm. through, and that's what his, I guess that's what his reward is for being there. You know, I do think that the movie does bring up a lot of the fact that life events transcends everything else, money, location, family. It doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is. If you're not well, none of that matters.
Well, I thought, getting back to Sid, I thought that Sid's inclusion in this, and then when when Matt has the conversation with him in the middle of the night and he learns that his father is recently deceased, Matt's reaction is very silent, and he doesn't really say anything, and then he just basically says, good night, I'll see you in the morning. But
mm-hmm.
the look on his face is kind of like, you know, you too. Like everyone is dealing with something. You
right.
know, we're all dealing with loss. We're all subject to it. We're all surviving or trying to survive things that have happened to us. And I think he starts realizing right then that he's not the only one.
And
you
also,
know.
That's I like that you said that, because that brings me, I want to just dovetail back to what you were saying about the father at her bed towards the end of the film when
right.
he brings the brother and the mother, Tutu, the grandma, Tutu,
right.
and the father. That father, played by Robert Forster, mm-hmm. is really all alone, too. He's already lost his wife.
I thought that, too,
Alzheimer's,
when he was looking down at her. It's like, I lost my wife, now I'm losing my daughter. And
right.
he's not very supportive of his son. Earlier on, he says, well, he
right.
wants to be gay, like, that's a horrible thing. And he's, you know, he's betrayed him, too,
right.
you know, by not being what he wants him to be. And so he's really, his family situation is really bad, you know. And, I
and
think
he's
that's
all
why
alone.
Matt,
right.
He's all alone.
He has
and
nobody.
I think that's why Matt's looking at him and saying, you know, gee, almost like kindred spirits where, you know, we've got real family issues here, both of us.
And yeah, I do. That's and you know, the sad thing about, like, with Tutu, she's with Alzheimer's, it's the person sort of the walking dead,
right?
And
right.
I can say that because my grandmother went through it and I know what it's like. So it's not, I'm not
sure.
being,
yeah.
people are listening, I'm not trying to be offensive, so I know
right.
the horror of that disease. So okay. There's something that was said that I thought was interesting when they land on Kauai to go try to find Brian Spears. They run into the cousin at the airport and he says, "Oh, I'll give you a ride." And
right.
he's like, "Are you sure?" And he's like, "Yeah, I got nothing but time." And here's
mm-hmm.
this element of time coming up again in mm-hmm. and we, you know, juxtaposed
point, yeah.
against all these things. It's that dual meaning of, we really in life, it doesn't matter what you have, money, cars, whatever. You only have time, but the ironic part is that we don't know how much of it.
Correct. Right. Right.
We go around thinking, I got nothing but time, but really maybe you don't.
Right.
You know,
it's also about time when they go and they see the property and
oh yes.
The younger daughter says, "What about me? You know, I
never got to
camp
here."
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I never had my time with this legacy from my family, you know. You are all saying it's over, but it's not over for me. I'm just getting started. So,
and they
yeah,
do. I think Matt at that point says everything has its time, and you know that land was there before them, before his family, you know, had claim to it, and it'll be there long after they all go. So it
right.
kind of brings up the point that we're all just a speck on the earth for a little bit of time, just a moment.
Right, right. right.
You know,
and
we're all just visitors.
Right, and that there are things so much bigger than we are that we don't totally understand, and that somehow we become trustees of, you know, we're supposed to figure it out, but we really aren't totally qualified to
right.
do that. And I think that's so much part of his struggle when it comes to the land is, you know, and you see the pictures of his great-grandparents on the wall in his study, and, you know, he's always being watched over in a sense, and how do I best serve them and serve the land and serve my children, and, you know, because I am just a connecting link. So,
and we're yeah, and it's just so now. We know he runs into Brian on the beach, basically, almost runs into mm-hmm. him, and then he confronts
right.
the other man. And we find out right before, I think, is it right before that or after that, that this Brian Spear, the realtor, is going to have part of the deal if the land gets sold.
So wife Julie tells him.
Right. And she
no,
tells
I'm sorry.
Him,
no, his
the cousin
tells him at
Beau
the bar.
Beau Bridges tells him.
Right,
and
he tells him at the bar.
Right, he has, and Matt King has this moment of like, you know, like what? It's just another unexpected upheaval, if you will.
Right, right, and it's also more of a betrayal, I think, because now he's might be thinking, well, Brian, well, he tells Brian, you only wanted, you know, my wife because you wanted to get to me, but there's also that question, and I think that goes back to the money, and again, maybe it was fleshed out more in the book, that did she want to fall in love with this guy who was about to become a multimillionaire and live a better lifestyle than she thought she was getting from Matt. Which, they had a lovely house, by the way. But, you know, like, what was her impulse to
right, what
get
was her motivation?
To this guy?
I have actually, it's funny you say that because in my notes exactly say I have did Brian Spears work Elizabeth to get information about the deal to, so mm-hmm. he could reap the benefits, or did she hook up with him so she could get the money that she wasn't getting directly from Matt in the marriage?
Right.
She'd
right,
get it on the back end.
Right.
Right.
Was
no,
she,
I agree
she,
with you.
Yeah, was she the one that was actually looking to get out and get the money, or was it Brian? Now, Matt doesn't go there. He doesn't – I don't remember him ever saying anything like that about her, but he does say to Brian Spear, like, you just, you know, you just went after my wife to get after me. And Brian says, no, it was just sex. You know,
right? Basically, yeah. It just happened. That's what he says.
Yeah,
it just
happened.
Yeah.
Which that whole conversation was very suspect.
Yeah, it just happened. And yeah. I have to say, there, you know, when he was in the house with him, and you knew you had, you know, you felt with Judy Greer, who's a wonderful actress and played the wife Julie Spear. Mm-hmm. You know, you knew she was being gracious, but she knew something is wrong.
Right.
And, you know, she was going through the motions like we do in any crisis. She was sort of having her own mini crisis because later on when she comes to the hospital room to forgive Elizabeth, she does say, I smelled it on him. I smelled it before you showed up.
Right. Right.
On the husband, and you know that he was cheating. So she kind of was having her own thing. And in the meantime, while she's having this, she's like, oh, can I get you something to drink?
Right, right, right.
You know, yes. And I'm sure you know, with all the people you deal with, that people kind of go through the motions. Do you find that?
Oh, absolutely. And I thought when he kissed her goodbye, Matt did, and planted
yes.
one right on her, you know, and it was a bit of aggressiveness on him, basically. You know, you touch my wife, I'm going to touch yours. But her reaction to it, I thought, was interesting, where I think at that moment, if she didn't know before, she definitely knew.
She knew.
And yet she
yeah.
still didn't do anything. She was just kind of a deer in the headlights, and you know, she had done the drinks, and she hugged the girl, she hugged Alex goodbye. You know, she was very gracious and very sweet, but there definitely was a lot going on under. And I personally used to feel that all the time. Like, you know, people don't know how bad it is for me right now because I'm playing a role that it's not. I think people do that all the time, especially when they feel vulnerable about what they're dealing with. And are not ready to share or not willing to share with everyone, you know. So at that point,
and,
she wasn't willing to share it.
It's almost like the masks that people wear, or, you know, the
mm-hmm.
roles that we play. And I, you know, there was something early on in the movie where the kid had been taking pictures and she gets in trouble at school for taking pictures
right,
of the
right,
mother
right.
in the bed. And
yes.
she says, well, so-and-so, the artist, did this, and when he did it, it was art. And
right.
and when I do it, it's wrong. Matt King, George Clooney's character, says, yeah, but what's going on with your mother is a private matter.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all human. It happens to all of us eventually.
Right.
So why
right.
is it private? It's like this sort of this confusion of how, you know, what things are supposed to be versus what they can be. And, you know,
right.
there's no... no democratization of, you know, tragedy, I guess, yet. We haven't
right.
we haven't
and I
pulled
think
away
that
curtain.
Right. And I think that was a struggle he went through the whole movie, is how do I tell people certain things, or do I tell people certain things? And again, for my experience going through cancer, that was a big thing of, you know, when do I tell my family? When do I tell my kids? When do I, you know, I even... My own husband didn't tell for a couple of days when I first heard there was something, which I shouldn't have done. He was upset about it. But, you know, it's hard to share bad news, especially when you are feeling responsible for everyone else. And at that, in this part in the movie, he does feel incredibly responsible for everyone else. And so that struggle of when do I tell people, you could see that through the whole movie he was dealing with that. And then sometimes he would lash out, you know, which was completely understandable too, and does happen to people in crisis. You know, you're dealing with so much and you start lashing out.
Debbie,
so yeah, I
just want to, let me just stop you right there. I want to come back to that point. We're going to go a little long. So live listeners, it'll end in a few seconds, but you can always hear the rest of this on the download, and anybody who will listen to it after the recording will get the full show, obviously. So we're just going to go a few minutes over our streaming time. So I like what you're saying. So it's the issue of when are you going to tell people, and do you think that it's because also there's something in that I think in our culture about when you say things, it sort of becomes concrete, so to speak, like it's suddenly real when you speak it out loud?
Absolutely. And there's also, on the flip side, there's also that vulnerability that, you know, when you're admitting that there's a problem, you know, you're admitting that there's a crisis or something that's tragic that we all now have to deal with. And so you're making it concrete, and you're also making it concrete for everyone else, you know. So that's what I really saw with his character was, you know, like, as I said, when he walked back into that room when she's putting the lipstick on his wife and his whole demeanor changed, he was really upset. He's stalking down the hall. You see him walking to the room, and he's just, like, overwhelmed. He walks in there. He sits down. You know, he needs to sit because he's been through so much. But then he softens. Like, it's just his whole face kind of softens where he relaxes, where, okay, I'm going into this mode now where not yet, you know, we don't have to face this. I don't have to tell you right now.
Right.
Even though, you know, in his head, in his heart, he's, you know, in complete turmoil, but he's doing this for them at this point, you know, and for himself. I just can't go the next step now. And that was a very common feeling that I had throughout it. You know, what can I handle now? Who can I bring in now? You know, how do I deal with this right now? You know, you can only do so much.
Right.
You see that struggle in the whole movie with him.
And it's almost like, is it like a kind of a relief? Like when he walked in the room and he saw them, he didn't. They were sort of an excuse not to deal with it at that moment.
It could be, and I thought that too when he finally brings everybody to the house and you see him initially alone, you know, drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all, you know, kibitzing and eating food. You see all the beautiful food, and they're smiling and laughing, and he's off by himself, you know, with a scotch. You know, he's contemplating, this is what I have to do. And the kid comes to him and says, I'm really sorry, and you know, this really, I think he says, really sucks or whatever. He says to him, he says, yes, I know. And, you know, he's getting ready to go in there and break their hearts. You know, he knows that there's a lot of people here who really love her. And then when someone says, can we see her, he's like, oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Like, he's, you know, he's really struggling with this whole thing to the point where he forgot the most important thing he wanted to say. And he's just doing his best, you know, as we all do in crises. We do our best.
And
I think that's what makes him so endearing.
and also on the flip side of that whole thing with the party, after he says goodbye to the last person, there's that moment he's in the driveway, and I was thinking as I was watching, I didn't notice it the first time through, but I noticed it this time, that George Clooney seemed like an old man, the way his pants were and the way he was standing, and he walks over to the patch of grass and he just sort of collapses.
Falls to his knees, yep. And I was going to I noticed that as the movie goes on, he looks older and older.
Yes.
That it's not, for me, it's not even just there. It's just as it goes on and on and on. And when you get to the last moment with his wife where they're, you know, putting her ashes over the side of the boat, you know, you see, I think he looks a lot older. Because in that week or so, plus it was 23 days before that. I mean, we meet him at 23 days in. But so now he's got a whole month of this. He's just aged so much in dealing with all of this.
And that's a good point. I hadn't thought about it in terms of the entire time frame, so it actually ends up being almost an exact month out of his life.
Right.
In 1 month, everything changed.
Everything changed. Yep. Yep.
And how quick it is, you know, and they say there's that fine line between life and death that we all walk, we just don't realize it. You know, it's not always front and center.
Right.
I just want to make a mention of Don Hollitzer, who is the invisible real estate guy who's kind of pulling the strings the land. We keep hearing about some group in Chicago, but then, you know, this guy with his money who wants this land, this property, is really kind of controlling, you know, we don't know how much he's controlling, but we know he's controlling the family dynamics and the King family. He's controlling Brian Spears. He's got it. So, and it's in the ripple effect of that, about how one person, again, can affect so many people and their actions and their interactions. But we never see him.
You never see him, no.
And it's that hidden money man, the money again driving things.
Right, right. And I think money is a big part of the story, which I think, I suspect that if I read the book, you would find that, and I really should, but I find that, you know, money is a bigger part of it than it is in the movie. Because there is that undercurrent of how did it drive his wife, how did it drive him? You know, he says that I didn't spend my money, but what's he working so hard for, you know? So there's all these undercurrents of money that may have caused a lot of this problem, a lot of this disconnect to begin with. You know, and certainly money is disconnecting them from the land.
I like what you just said about the money, that he isn't spending his money. Why not? I wonder if he doesn't spend his money the way he doesn't spend his emotions up to this point.
Right, right.
So it's sort of his personality, like he's holding back on the money and he holds back on everything else.
Right. Right, and he talks about how, you know, I'm like my father, and my father said, you know.
Right, don't give your children enough money to do something,
right.
But not so much that they do nothing.
Right.
Which I thought
was
a very clever line.
Yeah, and so he's trying, he's saying I'm trying to be a good parent, but, you know, really he's not because
he's not
invested
right.
emotionally. So he's
because it's
he's,
not about the money with parenting.
Right, right. So he's upholding this theorem of parenting as this is the way to do it, but he's missing out on all the rest of it. And that's what I get back to with, you know, becoming an inspired survivor, that he's going through all this and it's incredibly painful, but what he's getting out of it in the end, I mean, he certainly misses his wife and lost a wife, and that's a tragedy, but there's also hand in hand with that is his better relationship with his children that he probably wouldn't have had but for this horrendous experience that they all went through.
Right. Everything would have probably kept going on into perpetuity, which was the whole issue about the land, which is a whole legal matter we won't get into right now. But
and did you notice that?
Go ahead.
Did you notice that at the end, the last scene, they're sitting under the quilt that was on her bed when she was in the bed? That yellow quilt.
You know, that's funny. I did not notice that. Thank you for pointing that out. Mm-hmm. What I have a note that they're sitting under what I would consider a tribal print quilt, and they become unified as a family under that quilt. I didn't realize it was on her bed as well, so she was still with them in a way.
Right.
She was sort of looking down. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That's the bed. That's the quilt that I'm not sure if the parents brought it and put it on the bed. I think it showed up at that point. But it's definitely on the bed, and she dies under that quilt. And then in the very end, you know, I forget her name now. The youngest daughter is sitting
Scotty.
There under that quilt. Scotty, I'm sorry,
mm-hmm.
is sitting there eating, you know, and he brings her the ice cream, and then he puts it over his legs. And then Alex comes in later, and she kind of pulls it over her. And so it's this gradual coming together. You know, you don't, just the way it's directed, you don't see them all under the quilt at the same time. They all kind of come in separately and include themselves, you know, as now a family. And that's the mother's part of it, is this quilt, you know, that I'm still with you and we've really gone through this together. You know, her part was dying, but, you know, she's part of the family and this has been a growth experience for them through her.
And she'll always be there.
And she'll always be there, right.
Now, what about, I have a set observation that I want to just share.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed when they were scattering the ashes in the boat, you see them out in the water and it's open sea. It's the view of them out at, you know, from that point of view, beachside, out.
Mm-hmm.
And they're scattering, they have the traditional lays on and they're in a traditional boat and they're dispersing the ashes. And then they take the lays and they lay them on top of the water, and I thought it was interesting how they shot it from under the water up into the sunlight, and the lays remain on top, and Elizabeth, you know, her ashes float down, obviously disperse, so she's now in a different dimension, but they're still part of her, or she's part of them. It's all integrated, and then we see a shot of the back of Waikiki Beach against that beautiful ocean, and all that development.
Right, right.
You know, which is sort of what the tradition is sort of fighting, and you know, it's in where we go in every day in life.
Right. And yeah, and absolutely. And when he goes and looks at the land, and then the next shot is him in the car, you know, driving along, and he's looking at all these signs of, you know, Beachhaven Village and this and the golf course. And, you know, I mean, it's very obvious what he's thinking. You know, I've gone from this pristine, gorgeous, you know, naturalistic place that I've held sacred, and I'm going to turn it into this. You know,
right, and so that everybody, yeah, it kind of gets marred up, even though it's still beautiful, but it is,
right.
Yeah, it's like, do we do this to it, or do we leave it in its natural state? And that's also sort of representative of the family, is like the natural state of the family, I think, you know, where maybe it still does need to be built on. I don't know. I mean, that may be the question. I hadn't thought about it that way before. Maybe that is the question the movie asked. Is how much building
do
you
do? Right, say, I have 7 years to figure it out, because the rule of perpetuities runs out on them in 7 years, and that's what Beau Bridges says to him. You still have to deal with this. And he's like, well, but I have 7 years to figure it out. And so it's
so
not...
So we have... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's not... he hasn't come to a decision that is permanent, but he's realized, I can't do this now. You know,
and everything takes time.
And right.
So
and it's kind
so
of, too, I think
I,
he's been through so much. You know.
I read in some of the tweets about the movie that people were calling it, this is the most depressing movie ever. And I did loan my disc to someone, and they gave it back to me and said, I think this is the worst movie I've ever seen.
Oh, no.
And I know they were going through something when I gave it to them and they watched it, a personal upheaval, but I was like, really? I didn't feel that from it. And then I watched it again, and I have to tell you, I enjoyed it so much better the second time. But do you think it's a depressing movie?
I don't think it's a depressing movie. I think it's hopeful. You know, you're certainly looking at tragedy in a family's life. You're looking at death. You're looking at when they tell Scotty that her mother's gone, you know, it's a horrible moment of telling a 10-year-old child, a girl, you know, her daughter, that her mother is dying. So, you know, that's really powerful stuff. But it goes forward in the sense that we can rebuild, we can evolve, and we will always, of course, carry this loss, you know, and I think that's what the quilt is. We'll always carry this loss. We'll never forget. But we will go on. And so it's hopeful. I don't think it's depressing.
I didn't think it was depressing either. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, I thought this, especially after watching it again, I really actually enjoyed it so much more. I got a lot more out of it. I did like all of the casting very much. Thought it was very strong. And, you know, of course, we joke about George, but he really did do a beautiful job. And
he did.
And the girls were great. And, you know, I would have liked maybe to see a little bit more of Beau Bridges, because I like Beau Bridges, but who knows, you know, what happened there. And overall, I thought it was really good. I thought it was very interesting that at the very end, when they are under the blanket on the couch, they're not speaking, but we hear Morgan Freeman on the Penguin movie talking about Antarctica and about lineage and how they live and die and what they do in their lifetime.
Right.
You know, I just thought it was wonderfully done and simple and you know, another layer to this movie that was so well directed by Alexander Payne and just really, really beautiful.
Right.
Here's
the voice of God talking about it. I mean, if you need
Freeman.
The voice of God, you need Morgan Freeman. So that's what
that's
I thought I heard his voice. It's like, oh my
Debbie,
gosh.
Thank you so much. You know, I have to tell you, this was so much fun, and I'm so glad that you could be my special guest co-host. And
oh,
I'd love
I'm
to have you
Thank
back
you.
Again, so we'll have to find
Absolutely.
Another movie.
Yes.
And again, listeners, if you'd like to find out more about Debbie and read about what she's doing and join her there at her site, it is www.wherewegonow.com. So thanks again, Debbie.
Thank you, Lucy. I had a fabulous time, and call me back anytime. It was great.
I will. You got it. And thank you, listeners, for sharing part of your busy day with us on Chick Flick Chat. We understand that every minute counts, and we hope our radio shows and lifestyle information at HereWeAreWithLucy.com help to make your life better, brighter, and easier on your way to running the world. I'm Lucy Weston, and I thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to sharing time with you next time on Chick Flick Chat.